Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. That was our news bulletin and an ad break for you. Well, I'm going to be, unfortunately, we have no Mufti Hafiji this morning as he's unavailable for this slot. But the conscious consumer slot will be filled in with something pretty interesting. It's a money and debt and Islamic perspective. So I'm going to leave you in the company of this particular clip, and inshallah it brings you some education and information. And I will see you or chat to you again, inshallah, next week, Sunday, on this particular program. But catch me during the week. And I will be hosting Maulana Kersani, Junaid Kersani's show, the daily roundup from Monday to Friday, inshallah. But I hope this is going to be very informative for you. I know it was for me, and I'm hoping that you would enjoy it. And like I said, I'll be back next week, inshallah. For me, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
يمحق الله الربا ويربي الصدقات.
Of the many features of Islamic civilization, one that often stands out to economists is the fact that the charging of interest was not part of its economic life. Today there are powerful forces at work that want us to forget that fact. They want us to believe that interest is an indispensable ingredient of economic success. But even in the Western world, where the practices of interest are most developed, things haven't always been that way. One of the most famous acts of Jesus' ministry was to kick the usurers out of the temple. 1500 years later, usury was still prohibited throughout most of Christendom. A succession of church gatherings confirmed the prohibition, among them the Council of Nicaea in 325 and the Lateran Council of 1179. Those who practiced usury were seen as parasites, earning an unnatural living at the expense of society around them. Today, everything has changed. Usury is no longer a criminal offence in England, no longer something to feel ashamed of. It's practiced everywhere, openly and unashamedly, and far from being sent to prison, those who do it best win prestigious awards. In around the year 1220 after Christ, a researcher in Rome named Hispanus argued that it was in fact permissible to charge for making a loan. But Hispanus said it wasn't permissible to charge from the outset of the loan. You could only charge if the borrower was late in repaying. The period in between the date on which the loan should have been repaid and the date when it was repaid, Hispanus termed inter esse, that which in between is. By the time of King Henry VIII, inter esse, or interest, as it was by then known, had been made legal up to the rate of 10%. Anything above 10% was seen as nasty, evil usury. Anything below was not usury, and was therefore permitted, which explains why today people talk of usurious rates of interest. Before the innovations, no such distinction existed. But even while King Henry was busy permitting interest, others were devising new ways of circumventing the church prohibition on usury. One of these ways was the triple contract, the Contractum Trinius, a combination of three contracts that the church viewed as permissible, but which, when put together, formed a loan at interest. In step one, the lender invests £100 with the borrower under a profit-sharing agreement. In step two, the lender insures himself against the loss on his investment by paying an insurance premium of £2 to the borrower. That way, he knows he'll always get back his original investment of £100, even if the borrower makes a loss in his business. And in step three, the lender sells his right to any profit on the investment back to the borrower for a price of £7. Taken together, the three contracts produce an interest payment of £5 on a loan of £100. In the late 17th and early 18th centuries, a new breed of thinkers, the economists, arose. One such thinker, Nassau Senior, promoted the idea that interest was justified because the lender of money gave up the use of that money. He gave up the pleasure he could have had by spending it instead of lending it. But there was a problem with this theory. What if the lender was a very rich man? With all those millions in the bank, you wouldn't have to give up very much pleasure at all if you lent one of your poorer friends a few £100s. But you could still charge him interest. Mr. Senior's theory quietly bit the dust. Yet the arguments in favour of interest continued to emerge from every corner of European thought. Calvinists supported the practice, as did many merchants who made their profits from borrowing and lending money. By the early 20th century, the Catholic Church capitulated too. In 1920, the Pope pronounced that it was no longer prohibited to profit from the lending of money.
Yes, I mean, I was nurtured on the understanding that usury was forbidden by the Bible, and also by the kind of teaching about ordinary life that my parents gave me. I realized it was common sense that money should not be exploiting others, that it should be based on the sharing of joy and sorrow and the risk and reward, which is a Muslim insight, and I was nurtured to believe it was Christian insight. So I was deeply disappointed as I discovered wherever I went that the church didn't face this issue, wouldn't discuss it, even when raised frankly before them.
After the defeat of the usury prohibition in the West, a very different kind of world began to appear, one in which the worship of God gave way to the worship of material things. Presiding over this new way of life was the market. Some economists went so far as to bestow upon the market powers that had hitherto been reserved for God himself. For these men, the market was all-knowing. Whatever it decided had to be right for society. The market was all-powerful. You couldn't fight it. You couldn't buck the market, to use Margaret Thatcher's old phrase. That the supporters of free market capitalism should today criticise religion for being an impediment to economic progress, for them to say that religion should steer clear of public life, these are among the great ironies of our time. For the fact is that free market capitalism has become a religion in its own right. It has a set of core values that students and public alike are infused with, values that are held above challenge, no matter what misery they may have inflicted upon the world at large. As time went by, some people began to argue that if the bank had issued £100 of paper receipts, it should keep £100 of gold coins in the vault as a reserve. But the bankers said that most of their customers didn't ask to redeem their receipts for gold. So for every £100 of paper receipts outstanding, they only needed to keep a small fraction as gold in the vault. This debate mattered vitally. With a fractional reserve of 20%, for example, the bank could take a deposit of £100 in gold coins, issue £100 worth of receipts to the depositor, and then create another £400 worth of receipts for lending to borrowers. A total of £500 of paper money would have been created, but there would only be £100 of gold coins in the bank vault. In 1844, Robert Peel passed the Bank Charter Act with the aim of preventing banks from creating paper money in excess of their gold reserves. However, the banks were one step ahead of the game. As soon as the Act was passed, they adopted a new system of money creation, the cheque and account system. Imagine there's just one bank in the economy with two customers who open a new account. They both start with a zero balance on their accounts and the bank issues them with a chequebook. Let's say customer A buys a watch from customer B for £100 and writes a cheque in payment. Customer B deposits the cheque in the bank, and now the bank credits customer B with £100 and debits customer A by the same amount. £100 of new money has appeared out of nothing in B's account, and A is in overdraft by an equal amount. Here we can clearly see that for every unit of money created by the bank, an equal amount of debt comes into existence. Notice also that if A repays the debt by depositing a cheque drawn on customer B, then money is destroyed. This is one reason that modern society simply cannot afford to repay their debt. Debt repayment destroys money and causes economic recession.
Have you ever been worried by being in debt?
Yes, a lot of times. Having just graduated university, high levels of student debt. Yeah, very worried.
Have you ever worried about being in debt?
Yes, I have worried about being in debt often.
How does it worry you?
It worries me because I'm concerned that I can't feed my family, I can't pay my mortgage. It's just a general level of stress.
Have you ever been worried by being in debt?
Yes,
how
I have occasionally. I think there's a nasty feeling of gradually, especially, say, unemployment or something like this, there's a nasty feeling of money running out finally.
Today it's the government that creates the paper money in our pockets, not the private banks. The banks create money in the form of electronic credits, credits that appear on our bank statements, and that we can withdraw using checkbooks or debit cards, for instance.
It is like a kind of hypnotism, it's a kind of confidence trick. And as long as you can actually put a bit of plastic in the wall and paper money will come out and someone will give you something for it, that's fine. But often you find when that system collapses, when there's a meltdown, for example, people can't get the money out of the wall, then the panic spreads very quickly.
Here's a graph showing the extent of bank money creation. The red bit at the bottom is the amount of money created by the state. The grey bit shows the amount created by the banks. Society is paying interest every year on that huge amount of money that's been loaned into existence by the banking system. When Abraham Lincoln wanted to finance the Civil War in America, he decided to print paper money himself. He instructed Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Chase, to print 400 million US dollars of Treasury notes. This Chase duly did, using green ink, hence the term greenback. By this measure, Lincoln saved the American government a huge sum in interest charges. The bankers weren't happy at all. A few years later, during the First World War, the British government decided to do the same thing. They created their own Treasury notes and made them legal tender. Here's one of them. Notice, it's issued by the Treasury on behalf of the government, not by the Bank of England. So why did society not demand an end to the creation of money at interest by private companies? One reason is that some businessmen found a way of making money out of the system as it was. They would borrow money from the bank at a rate of interest that was below the rate of profit they could make in their businesses. So, for example, if a businessman borrowed £100 at 5% interest and invested it at 20% profit, he'd pay £5 back to the bank and keep £15 for himself. But under this system, the tendency was for businessmen to borrow as much as they could. If borrowing £100 produced £15 of profit, then why not borrow £100 million and make £15 million of profit? The idea became to borrow as much as possible, which meant that companies would undertake large-scale projects, that they would grow big. And this is one of the results of that mentality. In the autumn of 2005, you could walk down a high street and buy electronic goods from any of these stores. Dixon's, The Link, Curry's, PC World, it looks like wonderful competition, just the sort that free market economists rejoice over. But there's less choice than you might think. All these stores are owned by the same company, Dixon's Group, PLC. Even in the building sector, you can see the results of leverage at work. Here's a village near to where I live in England. It grew up over hundreds of years, each house designed by a different designer, built by a different builder, to match the tastes of the people who'd live here. It's beautiful, isn't it? But they're not building villages like this anymore. This is what they're building just around the corner. Take one green field and build 600 identical houses on it, all designed by the same designer, built by the same building firm, constructed with the same sets of materials. These are houses built for profit by a big corporation whose directors probably wouldn't want to live here. And this is what we're losing. Variety, communities, life on a human scale. The big multinationals are coming to dominate human economic activity. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they're working on £6 an hour for the local supermarket. At the personal level, the pressure caused by debt is widely acknowledged. Lord Griffiths concluded in 2004 that approximately 12 million people in the United Kingdom suffered debt-related stress, some 3 million severely. And because banks like to lend money to people who have collateral, it's the wealthy ones who usually get the largest loans. This produces a kind of vicious circle in which the poor stay poor and the wealthy get wealthier. Perhaps most worrying of all is the impact that interest is having on the environment. 10 years ago, I published data showing that the world's most indebted countries are also among its fastest deforesters. When there's a huge foreign debt to repay, rainforest doesn't stand much of a chance. The fact is that our debt-based financial system is forcing us into patterns of economic activity that are destroying the planet.
Does the Bank of England create money?
You know, I've never actually thought about it from that point of view. I wouldn't have thought so, no.
What do you mean, where the money comes
from?
Yeah,
who manufactures it?
I don't know. I haven't got a clue, to be honest.
With such huge profits at stake, there would, of course, be resistance to change. The global banking sector can earn in excess of $1 trillion of revenue in a good year. That's a big lobby in favour of the status quo, a lobby that's prepared to spend at least some of its profits on advertising, on political lobbying, and in the academic world too. For example, the London Business School was promoted by the big banks of the United Kingdom in order to create the next generation of banking executives. If we could have an honest debate on modern banking and finance, the public would soon come to understand why so many of us are in constant debt. But honest debate is one thing that's in short supply these days. On the one hand, we're told that our financial crisis is the result of too much debt, but then we're told that the solution is for the banks to lend more. How can that be? 1,000 years ago, money in England was made from silver. 1 pound in weight of silver was minted into approximately 240 coins. Each coin was called a penny, and naturally enough, 240 pennies were given the name 1 pound. But the kings of England couldn't resist playing with the monetary system. From time to time, they'd force the people to hand in their silver pennies in exchange for new ones. The old ones would be melted down with a cheaper metal, copper was a common choice, and new coins would be minted from that mixture. Each new coin looked more or less the same as before, but coin for coin contained less silver. The king, meanwhile, could take the surplus silver obtained from the recoinage process and build himself a new palace, or fight a war somewhere. English merchants often suspected that something was wrong, and in many cases decided to put up their prices following a recoinage. What they were selling their goods for was a weight of silver, so if each new coin contained less silver than before, then they'd rightly ask for more coins in payment. By the year 1666 in England, the kings had debased the coinage so much that 240 pennies no longer contained anywhere near 1 pound in weight of silver. 1 pound had become the name for the unit of currency, a token of value, no longer a description of its weight in silver. When the first bankers arrived on the scene in the middle of the 17th century, they took the principle of token money to its logical extreme. They produced a piece of paper worth nothing at all and gave it a monetary value. That piece of paper was to make them rich beyond their wildest dreams. The early bankers were often goldsmiths who had safe vaults where they could keep their precious metals and jewellery. Merchants who wanted to keep their gold and silver safe would sometimes come to the goldsmith and ask him to store their money in his vault. The goldsmith would give the merchant a receipt for the coins deposited. Often the receipt would be made payable to the bearer. In other words, the one bearing the receipt back to the goldsmith could reclaim the coins. It didn't have to be the original depositor. Soon, a remarkable development took place in English society. Merchants began paying for their goods and services using the goldsmith's paper receipts. There was no point in going to the goldsmith, handing in the receipt, getting the gold coins, and then going to spend them if a shopkeeper would accept the receipt in payment anyway. This gave the goldsmiths an opportunity to change their business model entirely. Instead of acting as safe keepers of coins in their vaults, they transformed themselves into money lenders. And when people came to the bank to borrow, what the goldsmith lent them was not gold or silver coinage, but paper receipts, which they printed at no cost in the back of their shops. The goldsmith had acquired the power to create money out of nothing. The more paper money the banker printed, the more he could lend, and the more he lent, the more interest he could earn. It was therefore natural for banks to create and lend as much money as possible. But as they did so, prices throughout the economy began to rise. And if people came to the bank asking for redemption of their paper receipts in gold coins, the bankers knew that they didn't have enough to make good on their promises. If new money was created under the authority of the state, and if banks shared the profits and losses of their customers instead of charging interest, then the people would soon find themselves living a life free of debt. You don't have to be a politician to see the attractions of that policy. Do you think that this is an idea that can be accepted across the faiths? Do you find much support in other religious communities or indeed in other political communities?
Of course, my joy is just how at home I have felt with the Muslims' understanding of economic life, and particularly over the last 5 years or so, the restating of their position with such clarity and simplicity. And I believe that everything I hear them stating about how money should be used and the transparency of its activities and the nature of binding contracts and all those things seem to me to come straight out of the biblical tradition in which I have been nurtured.
But if the state is to control the issuance of money, isn't this a recipe for galloping inflation? What guarantee is there that the state won't issue as much money as it needs to suit its own political purposes? The answer, in my view, is that there is no guarantee, except where we use a commodity of some kind, gold perhaps, as the basis of our monetary system. Anyone could create money in this system. All they'd have to do is go out and dig for it. This is a method of money creation that accords with market forces, that has nothing to do with interest rates or the whims of a privileged elite. It's a just monetary system, and it would be the beginning of a golden age for any country that adopted it.
The thing is that paper money is a promise to pay that is never kept. You can't go into a bank and get your £10 worth of gold. That means it's only worth the paper that it's printed on. Whereas if you look at any gold and silver, this is the gold dinar and the silver dirham, and there's a five silver dirham. These have intrinsic value. In the time of the Prophet Muhammad, blessings and peace be on him, this dinar would buy a sheep. Today it would buy a sheep. In the time of the Prophet Muhammad, this dirham would buy a chicken. Today it still buys a chicken. That's zero inflation in 1400 years.
But reform of the monetary and banking system is only one of the changes that's necessary. In many parts of the world today, wealth is concentrated in very few hands. For example, here in the United Kingdom, less than 5% of the people own about half of the country's assets. The reason things stay this way is that people's wealth isn't taxed. It's their income that's taxed instead.
People are persuaded, more and more, less convincingly in fact, that really the theory of evolution is used to promote the present system. And it says, you know, we started off as apes, but now we have the Nasdaq. So what is there to worry about? And it's implicit in that. It's always getting better. If you look at the reality on the ground, more and more people are dying of starvation, especially in the third world countries. And this is all because of national debts are being created. Natural resources are being extracted for peanuts, for nothing, because all the national currencies are devalued. And as a result, the actual people, more and more, the number of children dying every second, is phenomenal. And this was something that was not considered at the recent G8 conference, is what is the cause of all these people dying. They didn't look at the financial system.
Within a few years of the arrival of Islam on the Arabian Peninsula, so much wealth existed that few poor people could be found to receive welfare payments. That was a cash surplus society, one in which interest-based mortgages and personal overdrafts simply weren't needed. It's hard to imagine that kind of life now, of course. We've lived for so long in an interest-based economic system. 300 years ago, when those early goldsmiths combined usury with money creation, it was perhaps difficult to foresee the consequences of their invention. Today, alas, those consequences are available to see everywhere. The rich people of the world go to bed suffering the stress of debt, as much as the poor people of the world go to bed suffering its hunger. It's rather sad that every time we have a financial crisis in the world, it's a group of bankers who are asked to come up with the solution. It's rather like putting the fox in charge of the chicken run. Banks make money out of people being in debt. It's just not in their interest to reduce the overall level of debt. So the solutions they bring to the table aren't really solutions at all. Like cough medicine, when what we really need is to give up smoking. I joined the Islamic banking movement in the 1990s in the hope of bringing a genuine alternative to the debt-based system that I'd grown up with. But what I found was my Muslim colleagues entering into Islamic triple contracts, following the footsteps of their Christian predecessors. And in this, they were being encouraged by some of the world's largest interest-based banks. We need banks, of course, to transfer money from A to B, to look after our valuables, to give us financial advice. To all of these things I say yes, and to the technology that goes with them. But to money creation for the sake of profit, I say no. This is a monster we can't reform. We simply have to defeat it. Because if we don't, it will defeat us.